Good afternoon and welcome to On the Docket. I'm your host, Patricia Salkin, Dean of Toro Law Center in Central Islip. Every Sunday at this time, we talk about current legal issues and how they affect you. Today on the docket, we're talking about civil rights issues on Long Island. 50 years ago, a landmark piece of legislation known as the Civil Rights Act was passed, outlawing discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin, and resulted in the desegregation of schools. A year later came the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which ended literacy tests and other schemes used to keep blacks from voting. In recent years, conflicts over voting rights and de facto school segregation have found their way back into the courtroom and public consciousness. To help put these issues into context and speak to how our own community on Long Island factored in historically to these debates, today we have Howard Glickstein and Elaine Gross. First, we'll start with Howard. Howard is Dean Emeritus at Toro Law Center and former staff attorney at the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, who helped draft the 1964 Voting Rights Act. He was also general counsel of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and later staff director. Welcome to the show, Howard.
Thank you.
First, can you tell us about your work in the 1960s, the legal issues at the time, and what you did to get involved?
Well, I was started at the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice in 1960, and at that time, the Civil Rights Division was only 3 years old. It had been formed in 1957 as a separate division within the Department of Justice. Prior to that, there was no major division, legal division within the government that dealt with civil rights issues. Now, in 1957, when the act creating the Civil Rights Division was passed, we were 13 years after the Brown decision of 1954. There had been very little progress on school desegregation. The statute in 1957 also had a small section that dealt with increasing the ability of the Department of Justice to bring voting rights suits. But the big issues, and at the time I joined the Department of Justice, were voting. That was a problem ever since after Reconstruction and after the Civil War. Education. Mm-hmm. The Brown decision was not being implemented. There was very strong resistance to school desegregation in the South. And another area that was very outrageous, where there was extensive discrimination, was in places of public accommodation. Mm-hmm. Places of public accommodation throughout the South and in other parts of the country, too, were often restricted to whites only. And this was a particular sore point for many of our citizens who had fought in World War II. They'd gone to Europe to fight for freedom. They'd gone to the Pacific to fight for freedom and then came back here and found that they couldn't go to the restaurant they wanted to or to the hotel they wanted to. And there was a strong feeling that something needed to be done about that in the 60s.
So what was the role that you played at the Department of Justice, which was an executive branch agency, in helping to get Congress to actually pass these two new laws?
Well, when I joined the department in 1960, the Justice Department had very little jurisdiction where they could actually bring cases. What we often did, we filed what a court called friend of the court briefs in cases that were going to the mm-hmm. Supreme Court. And on major issues, like the freedom rides, where citizens were beaten up as they attempted to desegregate bus terminals or railroad stations, on cases like the sit-ins, where young people sat in at lunch counters to try to desegregate them. We in the Department of Justice would file a brief. I mean, it wasn't as effective as actually having a law outlawing this, but the brief started to lay groundwork for legislation that was to come and built up public awareness. The one major factor that led to the Civil Rights Act of 64, and probably even more so to the Voting Rights Act of 65, was the power of television. For so many years, people talked about discrimination in the South. They talked about violence and nobody really saw it. They read about it. But when the American public could see dogs chasing people down the street because people wanted to vote, when they saw civil rights demonstrators being beaten up as they crossed a bridge in Alabama, that really got home to the public, and public opinion was being swayed, and that was very important in influencing the legislation.
Right. So do you think that that helped to get people rallying to call their lawmakers to indicate support?
It certainly did. Yeah, there was some lawmakers were naturally inclined to vote for civil rights legislation. Right. Some lawmakers wouldn't vote for it if they were carried out in a coffin. But there were many people in the middle ground, and public opinion really influenced that. Mm-hmm. The press did, and television did.
So you spent a career really from the beginning of the civil rights movement, or at least the involvement of the government in the civil rights movement, and are still active today. Early on in your career, you know, was there a defining moment or two, or something that you were most particularly proud of your direct involvement with?
Well, I was down in Alabama right after the Freedom Riders were beaten up in Birmingham and in Montgomery on Mother's Day of 1961, and the Department of Justice brought a lawsuit against the Birmingham and Montgomery police departments and against the Ku Klux Klan, which had stimulated these confrontations with the Freedom Riders. And I worked on that case and was down in Montgomery, and I saw firsthand, and as I had a little bit before, the impact of segregation. Mm-hmm. We had some black staff people in our group. We couldn't stay at a hotel. The hotels were segregated. We had to stay at Maxwell Air Force Base, which was outside of Montgomery. And I could see how humiliating that was to some people, mm-hmm. not being able to stay where they wanted to stay.
So a lot has been said recently about the need for continued desegregation policies for schools. It seems as though the issues that we dealt with in the 1950s and the 1960s are unfortunately still with us today. A recent UCLA Civil Rights Project report actually found that the Empire State schools are actually the most segregated in the country. What does this mean, and should we be concerned?
That's a very, very sad report. The civil rights groups in this country, when they started to attack major civil rights issues, started with education. They knew that a good education was a key to success, was a key to a good life. They started with that, and now the schools are more segregated than they were in 1954, mm-hmm. which is very, very sad. Why is it important for schools to be desegregated? Well, study after study have shown that students who go to school with people of different races and in mixed economic backgrounds are the ones that succeed most, are the ones that have the brightest future. And we're not seeing that now. This recent report showed not only segregated schools, but the disparities and the extent to which students were being expelled from school, a much greater rate among Latinos and blacks, and believe it or not, the same disparity in preschool. Can you imagine in preschool more minorities were being expelled than whites? What could they be doing that deserved to be expelled from school?
It's incredible. I think in the next half of the show, we're going to have Elaine talk to us about some of the issues here on Long Island that deal with school segregation issues as it's tied into housing, which is also another major civil rights issue. I want to thank you, Howard, and listeners, please stay with us because coming up, as I said, we'll be talking to Elaine Gross, president of Erase Racism. You're listening to On the Docket with Torah Law Dean Patricia Salkin on Long Island News 103.9. Welcome back to On the Docket. I'm here with Elaine Gross. Elaine, we're excited to have you on the show to talk about civil rights issues on Long Island, especially with respect to housing and education. Elaine's an extremely distinguished civil rights practitioner, the founder and president and CEO of Erase Racism. Erase Racism, which is a regional organization that began in 2001, leads public policy advocacy campaigns and related programmatic initiatives to promote racial equality in areas such as housing, public school education, and healthcare. Her work primarily serves Long Islanders. Welcome, Elaine.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit more about the work of Erase Racism?
Well, we have been focused on fair housing issues, since the beginning of our work. And we have looked at policies that can improve fair housing. We were responsible for getting newly strengthened fair housing laws on Long Island, one in Suffolk County and one in Nassau County. And we continue to analyze the kinds of policies at the state level and the local level that can either increase racial segregation or decrease racial segregation.
So have you been working primarily with lawmakers to either change the laws or to get new laws enacted?
And also with the community and advocating for those changes.
That's great. So in addition to the fair housing issues, and you might want to get a little bit more specific about that, but I'm wondering, you know, just in general, what sorts of civil rights issues are you seeing specifically that are affecting Long Islanders?
Well, I'd like to stress that the housing discrimination issue is a current one, not just a historical one. In fact, we have a housing discrimination lawsuit right now in federal district court. And we found that in Mineola, there was a for-rent sign on an apartment building there. However, when the African-Americans inquired about a one-bedroom apartment, they were told that there was either no apartment available or they weren't shown apartments or they were quoted higher rents, while at the same time the white testers in this instance who went were told that there was an apartment and they were shown actually more than one apartment.
You know, it's outrageous that this still exists because when I was in law school in the 80s, these were the cases that we read about in the 1960s where it was clear that it was illegal.
Yes, and it's still illegal, and we have strengthened laws, but we don't have the kind of aggressive enforcement of those laws that we absolutely need. So, and there is a further, I mean, if that's not bad enough that people don't have housing choice, there's this issue of how housing is placed on Long Island.
Mm-hmm. So
the teeny bit of affordable housing that we do have, most of that, if it is family housing, which is, again, mm-hmm. another little slice because some of that housing is for 55 and older communities.
Right.
The family housing is really placed in racially segregated communities with concentrated poverty, and the young people who live in that housing are districted to the lowest performing school districts. So it is a more complicated problem. If you're trying to buy or trying to rent, you are limited in your choices, and your children will be limited in the access that they have to a good public school education.
All right, so I want to come back and talk about the school and housing connection in a minute, but I'm just wondering if we could talk a little bit more about the state of affordable housing on Long Island and what is considered to be affordable. What definitions are we using?
Well, the state of, compared to other places, let me begin by saying we only have about 20% of our housing stock is rental.
Mm.
That's not even saying whether it's affordable or not. We just have very small amount of rental, period, as compared to something like 32% in the Hudson Valley, 45% in New Jersey. So you begin to see a big difference just right. if you look at the broader region. Then if you take that rental housing and look at the housing that's actually subsidized by the federal government, sometimes through state programs that the federal funds are funneled through the state, we then have even a smaller number of units. And we have only not even 2,000 units per year coming online, again, for all the rental. So it's very complicated to kind of get down to the the smallest number of what would be in reality available. We also know that there is a, because we're in such a high rent district here, mm-hmm. very very expensive to live on Long Island. A lot of people are having to pay much more than the 30% of their income for their housing cost.
Right.
So it is, it's very complicated. And if we look at the most expensive jurisdictions in the country, Nassau, Suffolk, is right up there. There are four other districts above us, including San Francisco and California, Honolulu, the San Jose, Santa Clara, California, and Orange County, California, and then the Nassau-Suffolk area. So it's both how expensive it is to live here. It's that you can't find, there's a very low vacancy rate for rental housing, period.
Right.
And so this just puts a squeeze on the affordable. And then the affordable is placed, when it's family housing, the affordable is placed in those communities where the children will not be going to a high-quality school.
Right. I know that you mentioned the housing discrimination lawsuit in federal district court. Do you think that we have any chance in New York State of getting to where at least New Jersey's state Supreme Court headed with their fair share housing to make sure that every community had their fair share of affordable housing?
Well, I won't say that we have no chance of getting there because, there are nonprofits like ours that are trying to work toward that. But we have very strong local control here.
Right.
And so we have such tremendous fragmentation. I mean, not only do we have 124 school districts, we have all of these villages and other municipalities in addition to the counties.
Right.
Where most places would just have a county. All of these zoning authorities get to decide what's going to be built there.
Right.
And that's why we don't have much multifamily housing, because they zone it so that you can only have single-family housing.
Right. So one issue is on the housing stock availability that is largely controlled by local land use decision-making. And then the second issue, just to recap, that we talked about was even when there is rental stock or affordable housing stock available, that real estate agents and owners are not following the law either in terms of who they are choosing to rent to or not to rent to.
Correct.
So can you also just briefly, you mentioned the connection with the availability of affordable housing and where it's located and how that impacts education and school segregation.
Yes. Well, the schools here, the 124 districts in Nassau and Suffolk County, they mirror the residential segregation. So most of our schools are also racially segregated. And if you look at the New York State Department of Education statistics, whether you're looking at the testing scores or the graduation rates, et cetera, the majority African-American and Latino school districts are not faring well. And there is a resource gap that is certainly plays a role in that. We have a documentary on our website, A Tale of Two Schools, Race and Education on Long Island, which really shows two different districts. One of them is Rockville Center that has some racial diversity in that district, mm-hmm. and that by has a policy which has the same curriculum for all of the students. In other words, you don't have a racially diverse district and then you put all of the African-American and Latino students in one particular school or in certain classrooms within the school. Everyone is has access to the International Baccalaureate program. And you'll see in the documentary that all of the test scores went up. The white Asian and the black Latinos beginning to close that academic gap in that school with this kind of an initiative, rather than what generally happens in the schools. It's further fragmentation.
Yeah, you know, education is a critical issue and something that I hope that we can get you to come back on the show to spend more time speaking with us about. But before I let you go, just to remind listeners, A Tale of Two Schools, Race and Education on Long Island. Elaine, what is Erase Racism's website?
It is erasedracismny.org.
Thank you. That wraps it up for us here at On the Docket. Howard and Elaine, thank you for joining us to discuss some civil rights issues on Long Island. And thank all of you out there for listening. This is Patricia Salkin, Dean of Toro Law Center. Please don't forget to listen to us again next week for On the Docket. The show airs every Sunday at 4:30 on Long Island News 103.9. Have a great week.